director, Gavin. I'm trying to get your attention.
I want to get this started a little early today because we have a class of mine coming in at 1:30 that's running this world simulation. And we're going to need this room and close to the center. So I'm going to have to cut this off sharply at 1:25 if we're not done. And given this to Randy, has a lot to say.
Oh, yeah.
I wanted to make sure we had plenty of time to have him on the program. We're going to do more of this this year. That is, bring our own colleagues to the podium to talk about their recent work. It's really important, I think, that Sean highlight what we're producing here, not just what people around the country produce and bring to us as by way of our involvement. So Randy agreed to be the kickoff from the inside this year. We had Bill Little last spring, and I hope to do that pretty regularly throughout the year. Randy's written a new book, and we're going to hear about it today. So we all know Randy. He's a professor in political science and expert in international relations. For those of you who don't know him, but I doubt there are many of you here, who has traditionally been associated with the Realist School of Thought until this book.
Yeah, we'll see. We'll see if I'm still a member in good standing. Okay. Whether John kicks me out. So you want me to do the post-election analysis instead of the Republican? I'm glad. I'm happy to do this.
Nice you're doing the...
Yeah. Okay. Yeah, that's good. That's good. So you want to know what I've been doing here the last 5 years, probably. Okay, well, here it is. This is actually coming out. It should be out already in International Security, but they're a little late, so it'll be out in the fall issue. It's a very long 50-page article in print, and it's very dense, and I think I'm going to butcher it in this talk, but... trust me, the article is better than the talk. I know that's, you know, a caveat, but how did I get started in this? Okay. Well, let me start with a domestic analogy of the thing that I'm trying to explain, which is a concept called underbalancing. And you're all international relations people, so you probably don't need this, but I'll do it anyway for those who don't. In 1625, Charles I assumed the throne. He was the Stuart King of England. And he went through a kind of tumultuous reign where it was filled with controversies and disputes, largely of his own making, whatever. But he's in the late 1630s, all he could think about was building a new palace, one that at Whitehall. He didn't like the old palace. It was too sprawling, and it didn't represent his magnificence. The way he wanted it to be represented, and he wanted to match the Louvre. He felt, you know, this obsession with the Louvre and how he needed a better castle, better palace. So that's all he thought about for 3 years, is building this palace. But unfortunately for him, he was kind of gone by the time the palace wasn't even built, and he was already the Civil War started in 1642, and he was beheaded actually in 1649 right outside Whitehall. And it's like a classic case of, you know, the remote and isolated leader, ruler, who doesn't know what's going on, thinks he's much more secure than he is. First of all, does anyone know of a word for that? Because, you know, we have paranoia. People call you paranoid. Everyone's been called paranoid at least once in your life. And we have it's a common word about, you know, to describe the idea that, you know, you think people are out to get you, but they're not, right? But what is there might be a word for this, but I can't think of it. What's the opposite for when you think everyone loves you, but they really can't stand, you know, they can't stand you?
Whoosh.
I thought it was French. I thought it was kind of a French word. But it is actually French. The translation of Bush in French is, well, anyway.
It's delusional.
Right. Delusional. And I did say deluded. He was self-deluded. But I don't think that's the word, is it? I mean, it doesn't really cover hubris, maybe. Hubris. But that's like overconfidence, not the same thing. Anyway, there's this bias against this idea, and it's in the literature as well. There's this, you know, this bias against, it seems to me, like, for example, in international relations, we have all kinds of studies about overreactions to threats. You know, you believe that there's a threat, but there really isn't. Everyone's out to get you, but they're not. Right? But we don't have any studies about underreaction to threats, or very few. appeasement, but I'll go into that. Appeasement, there is appeasement, but it's always it's usually associated with the Munich analogy, and so I think it is with the Munich analogy, and really in the literature, it's almost always a condescending thing to say that they were under the influence of the Munich analogy. In other words, they thought this leader, like Saddam Hussein, was another Hitler when they should have appeased. Like, the literature's biased to say that appeasement really isn't a bad thing. It's underused. It's just that we have this Munich analogy and this association of appeasement with weakness and Hitler and stupidity and naivete, whatever. So anyway, there isn't a real lot of literature. Now, I thought, okay, well, maybe because, you know, we were in the Cold War, security studies grew up during the atomic age, and, you know, there's something to be said for not overreacting when, you know, we could all be dead in 25 minutes. So I guess there was no incentive to write stuff about underreaction to threats. But the Cold War is over, so I can do this now. There's a whole field waiting for me to tackle it. So now, underbalancing, I'll explain what it is in detail, but there are definitely important cases of it. In fact, I would say it's kind of the norm in some sense. If you think of Napoleon, only Britain balanced against Napoleon consistently. You think about Prussia attacking Austria in 1866. Britain did nothing. Take Britain just sat on the sidelines while the North defeated the South in the American Civil War. And just think if Britain had sided with the South, how different history would have been. I mean, for good or bad. But still, if you're Britain, your peer competitor was definitely the United States. They could have done something about it, but they didn't. They didn't do anything about Prussia. Didn't do anything about Prussia attacking France in 1871. And then you think World War One. Well, the Bismarck then, you know, he stymied balancing through a hub-and-spoke system, very clever diplomacy to isolate France. And then when you think about it, that system came apart when Bismarck was succeeded by Caprivi, and he stupidly turned down the Russians who wanted the reinsurance treaty to be renegotiated. And the Russians begged to keep the German alliance, and then the Germans turned them down flatly, and then the Russians had no choice but to go to France. So actually, the Franco-Russian alliance wasn't really due to balance of power, but more to the stupidity of the successor to Bismarck. Then, in World War II, nobody balances. I mean, you got seven great powers, you know, Italy, Japan, Soviet Union, America, Britain, France, and who am I leaving out?
Germany, right.
So, I mean, you have seven of them. None of them are balancing against anyone, right? I mean, some of them are hell-bent on aggression, but nobody's balancing. Then in the Cold War, you've got the United States and the Soviet Union are balancing, but nobody else is. I mean, in the Third World, there are no law. I mean, where are the alliance systems in the Third World? Where is the balancing? I mean, it probably doesn't exist. I mean, I can't think of too many cases of it. And then after the Cold War, the United States becomes the unipole, and everyone is saying, oh, the emergence of multipolarity is right around the corner. It's right around the corner. And, you know, we can't have a unipolar power. I mean, this is just horrible. So this is going to provoke, you know, alliancing and balancing, and yet I don't see any balancing. So, you know, where is the balancing, right? There's been a lot of underbalancing if you, you know, think about balance of power data and what it's not explaining. So the first part of what I thought would be an interesting part of the puzzle was to explain underbalancing, this phenomenon that nobody's talked about. The other part was just the general notion that we don't have a theory of domestic politics and balance of power. Balance of power is a purely structural theory, and it was thought to be like a law of nature. I mean, when we talk about balance of power, it's almost always as a law of nature, and that's the origins in the Renaissance period. Balance of power emerged in the Renaissance period. It really was never discussed prior to that. There was no discussion at all. And then in the Renaissance period, there was this idea that balancing, or balance in general, is a good thing. Balance is associated with everything good, whether it was music, you know, harmony, whether it was law, the scales of justice, or art and the idea of, once again, harmony, but let's see, symmetry, right. There's a whole, I listed here, why don't I just read it. let's see. order, peace, justice, fairness, moderation, symmetry, harmony, and beauty. And it was borrowed, it was a borrowed concept, like everything in international relations is borrowed from ethics, the arts, philosophy, law, medicine, you know, balanced diet, economics, and sciences. So it was just thought to be a real good thing. Balance is good, it's good in everything, it might as well be good in international relations, right? And it was mostly a domestic thing as well, it wasn't just international relations. So you have people like Rousseau saying, the balance existing between the power of these diverse members of the European society is more the work of nature than of art. It maintains itself without effort in such a manner that it sinks on one side, it reestablishes itself very soon on the other. And you get lots of these comments about the balance power being a work, you know, a law of nature, and therefore a good thing. And that carried over into writings like Morgenthau and Wolfers, and even today, you know, Mearsheimer, Lane. It's always discussed that way. Now, I know there's a manually operated balance of power, and I can get into that if you want to do it in Q&A, but it isn't domestic politics, is what I want to say. It's just still, it's once again, it's more of a structural notion. And so it was born as Age of Mechanics, where you say, you know, the whole universe is pictured as a, quote, gigantic mechanism, a machine or a clockwork created and kept in motion by the divine watchmaker. I guess that's Bush, right? Could be great. Anyway, the divine watchmaker. And this is the time... This is the climate which it was born, and I still say it's still discussed in this law of nature structural way. But in fact, you know, balance of power to me has to have a domestic component. Let me put this up here. Nicholas Spykman actually is one of the exceptions, where he writes the following. Political equilibrium is neither a gift of the gods nor an inherently stable condition. It results from the active intervention of man and the operation of political forces. You can read it. I hate doing this. You know, states can afford to wait passively for the happy time when miraculously achieved balance of power will bring peace and security. If they wish to survive, they must be willing to go to war to preserve balance against the growing hegemonic power period. It is interesting now when I read this that notice he said they must be willing to go to war for balance of power. So when you see all those quantitative studies saying that balance of power explains war and peace, it doesn't explain war and peace. I've written that elsewhere.
Let's leave that for another day.
But he's saying that balance of power is consistent with going to war. Just wanted to see. But anyway, the point of this is just that it isn't a gift of the gods. It isn't like it isn't a gift of the divine watchmaker. People have to consciously balance. And that's sort of what this whole book or paper end book was about how the obstacles or constraints on balancing, domestic constraints on balancing. So let me just put up the
I think you know the puzzle. I don't have to put that up.
My explanation for the underbalancing is a domestic politics explanation of balance of power. Simply that there are lots of constraints at the domestic level that explain why states don't balance. And in fact, I would argue balancing is a very difficult behavior. That is, it's easy not to balance. It's very difficult to balance. There's lots of reasons for that. But and that's what most of the talk will be about, these constraints on balance, these domestic constraints on balancing. But before I do that, I always get questions about balancing. And, you know, I had to come up with a definition because even though it's probably the most used concept in the field, we still don't know what it is, and you can never get two people to really agree on it. So I have this long-winded definition of balancing. So I wish I could say and read. I define balancing as, in a very narrow way, but I think it's the correct way, and that is just simply as the aggregation of military power through internal mobilization or forging of alliances to prevent or deter the territorial occupation or the political and military domination of the state by a foreign power or coalition. And then it gets more sticky. Balancing exists only when the stakes concern some form of political subjugation or more directly the seizure of territory, either one's homeland or vital interests abroad. And thus, balancing requires a state target their military hardware at each other in preparation for a potential war. If two states are merely building arms for the purpose of independent action against third parties, they're not balanced. Indeed, state A may be building up its military power, and even targeting another state B can still not be balancing against B, that is, trying to match B's overall capabilities to prevent B from invading A or its vital interests. Instead, the purpose of A's actions may be coercive, diplomacy, blah, blah, blah. And this final thing, balancing does not simply does not mean simply fighting back rather than surrendering after attack. Okay, because then everything becomes balancing. The theory is not, you know, it's not almost non-falsifiable because states tend to fight back when they're attacked in some form. So the point is, I guess, is to first of all define balancing, but also to say it isn't just making life uncomfortable for others. You know, because there's this thing of, you know, if you can pose, as Tom Christensen has this line, posing problems without catching up. Like, you can have cost-imposing strategies, but that doesn't mean you're balancing. It just means you don't like what's going on and there's other things to do. Diplomatic friction, whatever. There's this term now, soft balancing, by Haig, that, I like the guy. He's very smart. I mean, he's very smart, but this is too clever by half because it isn't balancing. It's just he wants to, you know, say that balancing is still going on, so he defines things that aren't balancing, that are really cost-opposing strategy as balancing, calls it soft balancing. But anyway, so having done that, I actually went to the University of Chicago, and they said, they gave me a lot of problems on this, this kind of thing. Alex was there. So it has something to do with me coming up with this scheme at the top, and I define it down here. And then conceptually, we have to get these issues on the table. I'm sorry, it might be boring. But underbalancing, how does it fit into the overall scheme of balance of power? Well, there's overbalancing, then there's appropriate balancing, there's non-balancing behavior, and then there's underbalancing. And why is it on a continuum like that? I'm not quite sure. But it doesn't matter. Looks very scientific. No, because overbalancing, underbalancing have to be on opposite sides. Anyway, so we have a literature on overbalancing, and that occurs when a target misperceives as aggressor, but is instead a defensively minded state seeking only enhanced security, and overbalancing triggers a costly, dangerous arms spiral. And this is, you know, the classic security dilemma notion, or a spiral model that Jervis came up with of how conflict occurs, you know, because you misperceive the other side. Appropriate balancing is when a target is truly a dangerous aggressor that cannot or should not be appeased, and the state's military capabilities are indispensable to counterbalance the rising state's power. Now, here's where they did, this is where the people in Chicago wanted me to put this in. I think it's right. What the hell? Non-balancing, which actually all these behaviors, inaction, normal diplomacy, buck passing, bandwagoning, appeasement, engagement, distancing, hiding, those are underbalancing policies. Those are behaviors that I would call underbalancing. But when they are, there aren't circumstances, in other words, when those policies are not irrational, they're very prudent. I would say that these circumstances are very narrow ones, and that is when this stuff, that these are when the state is thereby able to avoid the cost of war, either by satisfying the legitimate needs of the revisionist state or allowing others to do so, or by letting others defeat the aggressor while safely remaining on the sideline. So there are times when you can buck pass, in other words, and it makes perfect sense to do these things because you avoid the cost of war. But there are other times, and I think these are most often the times, when these same behaviors occur. And it's underbalancing because the state does not balance or does so inefficiently in response to a dangerous and unappeasable aggressor, and the state's efforts are essential to deter and defeat it. In this case, the underbalancing state brings about a war that could have been avoided or makes the war more costly than it otherwise would have been. So I think that's how the concept of underbalancing goes. It's the overall scheme of balance of power in these terms that we have for these behaviors. Okay, let me get into the meat of things. Okay, domestic politics. I want to talk, a large part of the domestic constraints has to do with this assumption that, we all know this, I'm not telling you anything new, but that structural theorists, particularly realists, tend to just do bean counts about states. So they take these, you know, material assets that a state has, and they just measure them, and they say the state is thus and thus, it's this powerful. So they assume, they make this assumption of similar or constant extractive capacity, so that all states can extract the same amount of resources given a certain amount of material assets. And we know that's not true. It's just a simple, you know, everyone would know this, you know, it's not. But you can divide into two things. And security hardware, which is these beam counts, the physical capabilities we're touching, and then security software, which is what I'm centering on. This is the thing that I wanted to bring up, is this focus on is this security software, which is regime legitimacy, national integration, and policy capacity. And essentially, security software assesses the external and internal environments and then attempts to manage and convert hardware assets to meet various threats. And this goes on, unfortunately. The software side of security management involves a political context and policy capacity through which national values are defined, threats and vulnerabilities are perceived and assessed, resources are allocated, and policies are screened. It's a long laundry list, but it needs to be there. You know, like I said, this is a very dense project. These things have to be. So, simply put, a state's hardware assets are only as good as the performance of its security software. And so, now there are lots of things you could focus on to get at this concept or notion of security software, how you allocate assets, how you extract material assets, and how you form strategies. And actually, you know, having read like Third World and Africa, what they have, they seem to understand very well that the most important thing in looking at a state's power, relative power, is its leadership, the unity of the country, the esprit de corps, things like that, these, you know, software kinds of elements. So now you could pick all kinds of elements to represent security software, but I think these four pretty much cover everything I need to cover. And that's where I'll go next. This is sort of the guts of what I came up with on domestic constraints.
So let me do these each individually. Well, I could read this first, but okay. First, let me just say that history, you know, just to set this up, this theory of underbalancing, which I actually call the neoclassical realist explanation, and I'll go into why, although I know a lot of you can say, what's realist about this? And, all right, I'm ready for that. But don't say it. Don't ask me that question. But let me set it up by saying, we know that history shows that states respond in various ways to similar changes in their external environment. And to me, it seems that this variation turns on the preferences of relevant political elites and social groups and the unique structural characteristics of society and government that constitute constraints and opportunities for these actors. And all of that leads to one political outcome or another. So more specifically, underreactions to dangerous shifts in relative power may arise for two basic reasons. First, policymakers' preferences, which are often more influenced by domestic than international concerns, do not create incentives to adopt a balancing policy, even when these same power shifts would cause other actors to adopt a prudent balancing strategy. This explanation for underbalancing centers on the willingness of actors to balance. The second reason for underbalancing, the general reason, is the potential domestic political risks and costs of balancing are simply too high. That is, the state, and here I refer to its leaders, does not have the ability to balance given the political and material hurdles that must be overcome to do so. So this kind of analytical framework or architecture is basically built on elite calculations of costs and risks, emphasize the point that statecraft is not simply a function of the particular geostrategic risks and opportunities presented by a given systemic environment, that is, of objective material factors at the structural systemic level analysis. It is also a consequence of, one, elite preferences and perceptions of the external environment, Donna like that, two, which elite preferences and perceptions matter in the policymaking process, three, the domestic political risks associated with certain foreign policy choices, and four, the variable risk-taking propensities of national elites. Okay, so that's a mouthful, but as I said, it has to be in there. So the first one is elite consensus. And here, the key questions with respect to elite consensus and balancing behavior are, do policy elites agree that there is an external threat? Do they agree about the nature and extent of the threat? Do elites agree about which policy remedy will be most effective and appropriate to deal with the threat to protect the state's strategic interests? Do they agree on the domestic political risks and costs associated with the range of policy options to balance the threat? And I tell you why there might be variation in this elite consensus. Now, you know, I mean, it may seem obvious that I'm going to, you know, borrow Don's
ideas here for a second, but this is basically problem representation, right? Because what I'm saying is, how do elites perceive their environment? Do they see it as threatening or not, right? I mean, this is a basic question. Now, we just can't assume that states and elites are going to agree about this question. I mean, there are all these things we have to ask about it. Now, you have to know, Hitler was an enormous threat, right? And to use Wolfer's house on fire analogy, the house was clearly on fire. It wasn't smoking. It wasn't a little overheated. It was on fire, and yet even Hitler didn't provoke the single exit option of everybody down. And structural explanations are basically single exit or straitjacket sort of explanations. You have to go this way. Everybody is moved by irresistible temptation or compulsion, external compulsion, to do something. But you can't get an environment, it seems to me, that has got that kind of compulsion in it to do one behavior. Anyway, elite consensus, let me just say something about this variable. It's the closest, most proximate cause of the thing I'm trying to explain, underbalancing, or the opposite, appropriate balancing, right? Like, if there is no elite consensus to balance, there won't be any balancing, period. But elite consensus by itself doesn't mean there will be balancing, because you can have elite consensus that you shouldn't balance, right? So it has to be a specific elite consensus. They all have to believe, or there has to be some consensus, that balancing is the appropriate strategy, and there are lots of choices they could make, right? So this is the proximate thing. I can almost make it the dependent variable. It's so close. Let's talk about government regime vulnerability. This question asks, what is the likelihood that the current leadership will be removed from political office? Does the government face a serious challenge from military opposition parties or other powerful political groups in society? What is the relationship between rulers and rule? Is the government authority based on coercion or is it legitimate? Is the government meeting expectations of the people? Does it enjoy broad support from the masses? Can it minimize domestic interference in its policy decisions? And this just simply captures the idea that unstable regimes are constrained in what they can do. And they're very unlikely to arm their populations to balance, for internal balance, because they're just worried that these arms might be turned more against them than against the enemy, right? So it simply captures that notion that, the more stable a government, the more likely or the more capacity it has to balance. Social cohesion. Okay. Social cohesion. This is captures, and this is very important, I think, the unity of a country. How unifies it socially. And I borrowed here from Lewis Kozer and George Simmel the in-group, out-group notion of conflict. And remember, the simple idea is that external conflict creates internal unity, right? And that's the hypothesis. But that's not what Kozer said or Simmel said. I mean, they said something like that, but there were lots of caveats. And, of course, the caveats, nobody reads them. They've forgotten them. And so it just got simplified into, external conflict generates internal cohesion. But, in fact, that'll only happen if there's a widespread belief that the group is a going concern, its preservation as an entity is worthwhile. Also, the outside threat has to be seen as a danger to the group as a whole, not just part of it. And there has to be a reasonable chance that if the group unites, the enemy can be defeated. So, if you don't get these kinds of things, let's start with first. If those things are present, then states with high levels of political and social cohesion are most likely to balance against external threats and experience an increase in public support required for the regime. Fragmented states will underreact to dangerous threats through these things, and severely fragmented states in the pre-crisis period can be expected to further disintegrate and even crack under external pressure. So, states with high social cohesion are going to balance or have a good chance of balancing. States that are socially fragmented are less likely to balance. By elite cohesion fragmentation. I talked about elite consensus and said that, it's basically how do elites perceive the environment? Is it threatening or not? Should they balance? But even if they believe they should balance and the environment is threatening, you still have this notion that they don't know who to balance against. you might think it's threatening, but you have to all agree on who's the number one threat. I mean, in Steve Walt's notion, you know, states bounce against the number one threat to their, you know, survival. But who knows what the number one threat is? It's not obvious, often, who the number one threat is. It's a political process that determines that. So what I'm saying is that this elite cohesion fragmentation is about, do we agree on particular policies, even if we agree that the environment is threatening? Do we agree on specific policies? Where do we devote scarce resources? With whom should we ally? Against whom should we ally? And these are all separate questions, right? Whom should we ally with? Against whom should we ally? Who are there multiple threats? Which ones, you know, have to prioritize them? And these are just, you know, things that may be obvious, but you just can't slough them off and say, oh, you know, it's all obvious. You know, and in some ways I feel apologetic presenting this because it's so obvious to me that, you know, that these things should be considered. But I guess it just goes to show how we get away with so much in this field. By writing books and creating theory, we all know balance of threat theory, right? And we all know balance of power theory. These are obvious. First, you know, political IR 101, right? And yet nobody, I never hear people saying, well, all right, well, who is the most dangerous threat? Why does Walt assume that this is so obvious to everybody, right? And he says, my theory explains everything about power and everything and more. Well, why? Why does he think that? Because he's simplifying. He's saying, well, if you get two sides that are equally, if you get two sides that are equally material, have relative power, the same relative power, advantage, or whatever, then balance power can't, it's indeterminate. It doesn't know which one to balance against. But I add the component of threat. Therefore, you know, now I can tell you the one that's more threatening is the one they're going to balance against. But I could say to him, but wait, how do I know which is more threatening? You're assuming that's so obvious which state is more threatening. Just, you know, not telling you the story. And somehow we buy this stuff. Anyway. Now, okay, those are four variables, but how do they go together? They go together in a lot of different ways, I'm afraid to say. But, hey, life is complicated. You know, it's a good thing. It gives us lots to write about, and, you know, we should never have, blocks, because there's just so much, that mental block, there's just so much to do. Anyway, this, if you take away anything from this talk, what I'd like you to take away, is just simply that any balance of power model should have this in it. That's, okay, changes in relative power, states take their cues from changes in relative power, we hope. Then you have that elite consensus about the nature of the threat and some degree of elite cohesion. Remember, that is, who's the threat, where is it coming from, what do we do about it? Then you have to consider mobilization hurdles as a function of regime vulnerability and social cohesion, and then continuity or change in foreign policy, either balancing, bandwagoning, the peace.
What do
these arrows
represent?
Nothing. Well, I just think that in a sequence, this is probably a decent sequence, but it doesn't really. I could have made them. I do in the next one, make it an additive model. But here I'm just saying, okay, you have change in relative power. Elites look at that change. They try to decide what's going on and what to do about it. Then they consider, they might do this simultaneously, really, but they consider the mobilization hurdles, their vulnerability, and social cohesion, and then they decide what to do, which is the best thing to do. It probably happens very simultaneously. But if it does, I have the additive model. For all quantitative types, if you were doing this, you would just add it up and tell me which is causing most of the variation. And I have this, where it's simply, you know, social fragmentation cohesion plus government or regime volatility or stability, and plus elite fragmentation cohesion, elite disagreement, or a non-balancing consensus, or elite balancing consensus, and then you get underbalancing or balancing.
Okay, so it's just a simple additive.
Causal scheme 3, extremely incoherent states model. This is the Kozer idea that you have a rise of an external threat, you have a very socially fragmented society that gets more socially fragmented because of this external threat. The government regime becomes more vulnerable because the people are riled up and they don't, you know, they're threatened and they're cracking apart or splitting apart. Then you have elite disagreement on how to respond to threat or elite consensus not to balance. And then you get underbalancing behavior and very high probability of further state disintegration, civil war, or revolution.
I have two more. The
polarized democratic model. This is kind of France, I think. Yeah, this is France in the 1930s, sort of. Rise of an external threat, high degree of pre-crisis social fragmentation and government instability. That leads to an elite consensus that the external environment is dangerous and the state must adopt the balancing policy. But elites and social fragmentation regarding with whom to align and against whom to balance leads to even greater government instability, leads to underbalancing in the form of half measures and incoherent grant strategies. This is the only one where really elite consensus is the proximate cause of underbalancing, one way or the other. It's really elite fragmentation. But it's being driven by social fragmentation, which when I talk about the case a little, you'll see. How much time have I used?
A lot.
Oh, boy. Okay. Call this being by underbalancing through wishful thinking, a two-state threat. This is like Britain in the 1930s. Here, it's possible that elites can believe that the environment is threatening, but when they face these high mobilization hurdles of a function of regime vulnerability, social fragmentation, or cohesion against war preparations, and elite fragmentation, notice I say social fragmentation or cohesion against war preparations, because cohesion against them would also lead to resistance to balancing. And elite fragmentation leads to elite consensus to downgrade the threat perception through wishful thinking, other motivated biases, and then you get some form of underbalancing. And here what I'm just saying is that so leaders do know there's a threat, but then they see this resistance, and then they say, oh, maybe it's not such a big threat. You know, maybe it isn't. And I think this goes on a lot. In fact, just for you cognitivists out there, I had a, in the district, in the book. In the book, I have a chapter on various things. One of them is threat perception. Because obviously if you're saying, well, states are underbalancing, they're not balancing properly, you must be talking somewhat about threat perception. And I went through the psychological literature looking for stuff about threat perception. Where else are you going to go, right? And I got all these nice things, but all of them were about overreaction to threats. I couldn't get anything where, you know, maybe you know some stuff, where there's cognitive biases against recognizing threats that are actually there. Maybe the closest thing is wishful thinking. But, there's all kinds of things where you think the enemy is, you know, big and bad, and they're not, but I can't find the opposite. But there was one interesting thing I found was the Copenhagen complex, which is this weird thing that happened in Germany prior to World War I, where the German people were obsessed with an attack by the British, a naval attack out of the blue by the British. They thought it was coming, but there was no evidence at all that the British were going to wage this bolt out of the blue attack, naval attack. And yet the people, they were psychotic. And so, so these misperceptions or these pathologies don't just affect individuals or elites, they affect whole populations sometimes, where they just are all pathological. You have to read, if you want this article, I'll give it to you, it's very interesting. And I think that that's sort of what explains this, is that, like, the whole population of Britain just didn't want war and thought there wasn't going to be a war, because we didn't want it, so it wasn't going to happen. You know, the Germans really weren't that bad, and we don't have to arm. It's not that dangerous. So, you know, for what it's worth. Now, this is just a really clever graphic. What it does, I'm not quite sure, but it's very clever. It's just a way of the additive model. And if you think of elite consensus as the proximate thing, I need to get three variables on one sheet of paper in a flat space. And this does that. And I ripped it off from Chopin. I ripped it off from Schottenway. Who's that guy, the IPE guy? Schottenheimer. He doesn't do balancing, but something else. But it gave me the idea that you could put three variables. Anyway, so you can see, if most other variables are lined up in one direction, then you should get a balancing consensus. And if the variables are lined up in the other way, you should get a balancing consensus, should be least likely. Okay? So it's just a neat way to present this.
So cases. There's a lot. When you ask questions, there's a lot. I don't want to go into cases. It's boring. When I'm sitting in a talk, I don't want to hear about it. That's the problem with qualitative work, is that case study work is, a lot of times, it's very boring. And, you know, if I had quantitative, I could just throw it up there and you could be bored. You'd be before, but it'd be so painless that, you know, but here I have to actually do this. Anyway, we're going to say something about Britain. I'll do it real quick. In fact, give me 5 minutes to do three cases. It's good, because I don't want to do the empirical work. But in Britain, if you read the book or the article that's in IAS, you'll see I explain this. I think people have underestimated the socio-political threat in Britain after the war, when they, you know, went from a wartime economy to a peacetime economy. British elites were terrified of a revolution. And, you know, maybe it's crazy, but they thought there would be. And they did not, you know, their choice was, on the one hand, social reforms, disarmament, and financial rehabilitation. And on the other hand, armament. You know, building arms, balancing. And they, obviously, everybody chose the first one, you know, not to balance and to do all these things. So what you see in Britain is that, in this case, from 33 to 36 at least, when there's a threat, you get almost a consensus, a large consensus for a non-balancing policy, for appeasement of some kind. But for very different reasons. Only Churchill, he's the only one that says arms and allies in this period. You know, I said Winston Churchill, conservatives, that's like three people, you know. The rest, you know, he's the only one. Everybody, but they, what I'm trying to point out here is that appeasement or some non-balancing policy is like a default. It's the default option. Like, and it's easy to arrive at because you can come at it from different, you know, directions. Anyway, so you've got the mass conservatives that want passive appeasement, limited liability, armed forces for national defense to promote British isolation and neutrality. You have Labour saying they want disarmament and international conciliation. They say yes to limited armaments for the League of Nations and collective security, but no to armed forces for national defense, believe it or not. Like, it's crazy. This is when Harry was elected. liberals, strongly pro-League, opposed to rearmament and British neutrality. Southern, they oppose neutrality and rearmament in Southern and Eastern Europe, and they strongly oppose to economic nationalism. And then the Lloyd George liberals, they active appeasement, he almost pro-Hitler, the term for
Germany. Since this changes in 33 to 36, 36 to 39 after the Rhine, you know, remilitarization of Rhineland. And what you get now is two groups, the Chamberlain appeasement types that want active appeasement now, and then you get the Churchillian deterrence types, and they want armed coercive League. He couches very cleverly his balancing policy in the League of Nations. He doesn't believe in the League of Nations at all, but he knows he can't win unless he says something to the League of Nations. You know? So he says armed coercive League of Nations to resist aggressors. But here, you have a elite disagreement, and you get underbalancing, because once again, it's so much easier to arrive at, you can't just have a balancing strategy because some elites like it. You have to have, like, a consensus. Most elites have to want balancing, or you won't get it. So here again, it's just very difficult to get a balancing strategy. There's so many ways to not get it. You can think of veto. I have veto players in here. There's a notion that there are always going to be veto players. And remember, states, the normal, quote, normal policy is a non-balancing policy. So to get to balancing, you have to move people in a direction to balance. They're not gonna, it's not the status quo. It's not, you know, inertia will always lead to more non-balance. Let me put up France really quickly. France is a basket case, but mostly because it's always a basket. But it had extreme social fragmentation during the interwar period. Then this led to extreme regime vulnerability, and let me just show you what extreme regime vulnerability looks like. This is France, prime ministers. From 1914 to 1940, look at the number of prime ministers. I mean, it's like every 2 months, you know, they're changing themselves. This is extreme regime vulnerability, right? Foreign minister, it goes on and on. Oh, I'm sorry, you're French. you have my deepest sympathy. So, then, okay, unambiguously dangerous external environment. So, these variables work in this way, but what I want to point out is that there was an unambiguously dangerous external environment. I think the French clearly understood that. In fact, they were the only ones saying, you know, Germany is a danger. They were saying it long before Hitler. But then they disagreed with, you know, who to balance against. So you had the socialists and the communists wanted to balance, but with the USSR against Germany. The liberals wanted to balance with the League against Germany. The conservatives wanted to balance with Italy and Little Entente against Germany. And extreme right wanted to balance with Germany against the USSR and international Jewry.
right? So they just couldn't get it together, and what you got was, you know, half a Maginot Line is better than none, but it isn't. And like an American ambassador said, the French policy was one of a undertaker, not a true foreign policy. Now, it's interesting, I'm doing these cases very quickly, I'm sorry. I have this chapter on Paraguay and the War of the Triple Alliance. How many people know about the War of the Triple Alliance? Have ever heard of it, other than me? Well, anyway, there was like this world war in the 19th century in South America. And believe it or not, it lasted 7 years, and it pitted Paraguay against Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay. Look at the percentage of total population, 3.5%. And Paraguay initiated the war. And this chapter, I'm not going to go into it, but I'll send it to you if you want to see it. But it's all about like 60 years of nation building. And Paraguay was the paragon of nation building. They knew how to do this. And so they were the most unified country you can imagine. They were like hyper-nationalists, and they did all sorts of things to conform to what I would call the classic real estate, which is, I'm going to argue in my final chapter, which I haven't written yet, that is pretty much a fascist state. But anyway, it was a fascist sort of state. Argentina, Brazil, and Uruguay. Uruguay, you could forget about. Who cares about them? But Argentina, Brazil, right? They were just the classic examples of how not to build a nation. They were totally fragmented. In fact, Argentina had two capitals, one in the Port Chanos in Buenos Aires, and the other one in
São Paulo.
In what?
São Paulo.
No, Buenos Aires. And then the hinterland. Anyway. And so these are very fragmented states. So the leader of Paraguay, Caesar, has got these fragmented neighbors who are much larger than him, and he really likes realism. He admires Napoleon III. He's the only one that admires this guy. And he goes to Europe, and he comes back and says, I'm going to be a realist. I'm going to take over this continent. He acts like John Mearsheimer's state. He says, you know, we're a revisionist state, and we've got to take over the continent while we've got. You know, it's like, well, we've got the muscle. We've got to move in. And he lasts for 6-7 years in a war against the entire continent, practically. This tiny little state. But look at the losses. Look at the total population. At the start of the war, he fielded 70,000. They fielded 55,000. So he's actually got more forces than Brazil, Argentina, and Uruguay combined. And then he loses over 90-something percent of his male population, which I figure that's more than a nuclear holocaust. Right? I mean, if we had a nuclear holocaust, we wouldn't lose more than 90% of our male population. But he does. So you can see what fanatics they are. Because you would think by like when you lost 30-40% of your male population, the rest of the male population would say, enough. You know, I'm definitely next. But over 90%, I mean, it's astounding. Argentina only lost 10,000. That can't be right. But it is. It's right. But anyway. So, anyway, I don't want to talk, but it's an example of, this case for me is good because it showed that, first of all, I wanted to show no X, no Y. See, I showed that if you have X, meaning all those four domestic things, you won't get balancing. But I wanted to say, if those variables are in the other direction, you should get balancing or hyperbalancing or something to that extent. And Paraguay gave me that. And not only that, it was fighting, you know, neighbors that suffered from this underbalancing pathology, so they were weak, easy targets. You would expect that a state that's on the rampant, you know, would see this and want to do something about it. And they did. And they lasted a long time. So, to conclude, you know, there, you have to read the chapter. Honestly, look, but I'm just, you know, you don't want to hear it. So, I would just say, it seems to me that, well, let me just say something about the final chapter. I have to write a new final chapter. They didn't like the old one. I agree with them, but anyway. So the final chapter is going to be another heretical statement. It's going to say, like, it's entitled, Why Are States So Timid? And I'm going to extend the theory to cover under-aggression and under-expansion. Which, again, there's not a lot of stuff about why states are so timid. But they are. You know, when you think about it, states don't act like Mearsheimer says. I don't see any states searching for hegemony. You know, regional hegemony. I mean, we've only got one regional hegemon, the United States, right? There has never been another regional hegemon. So I don't see it, particularly in the third world. I see lots of, you know, it's like De Gaulle had a good line when he said, you know, Brazil has lots of potential and it always will. That's a very good line, I think. And I think it sums up a lot of what is happening, that there's a lot of timidity, there's a lot of undergression. I think these same variables could explain a lot of that. And just to sum this whole thing up, I think that at the very least, if we have structural theories, we have to connect them to some domestic level variables, or they don't really make too much sense. Because there's something missing. The story is not complete. Because obviously people do things and they have to do things, and you just can't say, well, structure constrains and we don't have a theory of foreign policy. Like when Walt says, I'm not talking about theory of foreign policy, he's wrong. I think, even though I think Colin Elman thinks he's right. I don't think that's correct. I mean, you have to somehow connect structural constraints to domestic realities and make it all work. And if you don't, you're just not telling the story. So, okay. Question.
Yeah. Randy, why do you need the word balancing? Why, what you're talking about is threat perception and mm-hmm. the reaction to threat.
Mm-hmm.
And I don't see why you necessarily need the word. It doesn't take anything away from what you're doing, but it just doesn't seem to be useful. Necessary.
Because I think balance of power, it should work, and states should internally build arms and form alliances to aggregate military power. Right, and balancing is one. But you would agree that balancing is one policy out of many. Like you could appease, you could negotiate, you could bandwagon, you could buck pass, but balancing is certainly an option. Right?
Increasing military force as one method for reacting to this.
And building alliances, right?
Yeah.
So you could do that, right? I mean, what would you call U.S. behavior in the Cold War? If not
reacting to Soviet threat.
Yeah, but you can react all kinds of ways. So. All right.
You're explaining a lot more than just balance. You're even talking about under-aggression.
Mm-hmm.
Like that, which has nothing to
right,
do
I'm not just explaining balance.
So
I mean,
why are you tying into balancing? Why not just...
Oh, why? Well, because balance power is a big target. You know, it's the oldest theory in the book, so, I mean... Yeah, so if you want to, you know, if there, you have a springboard, you need a springboard from somewhere, and that's a good one.
Well,
but,
Randy, you can see the question. You had the graph up, and
right.
Non-balance.
Well, that's what they wanted at Chicago. Something
yeah,
like that.
So blame Chicago.
Yeah, blame it Chicago. No, I think they're right.
Blame that philosophy, so.
But I think they're right. I think they're right because the same policies that I'm calling underbalancing can be appropriate given certain external environments.
Okay.
Like if I can pass the buck, why shouldn't I do it? You know?
But now go to underbalancing.
Right.
Here's like the question I wanted to ask. Under your second clause,
mm-hmm.
what seems to be doing a hell of a lot of work there is this word essential.
I agree.
What is it to be essential?
Okay, that was another question we got in Chicago. So, all right. What you mean is, I think what you're asking is, ex ante, how do I know what's the threat? Ex ante, how do I know what's appropriate? No, and that's a good, you know, I have it somewhere,
my ex ante test. But I wrote a chapter on it, and I didn't want to discuss it because it's very dense. I mean, I just gave you a skeletal overview of what I was doing. It's not, but I think what you have to do, it is threat perception.
It is threat perception. It's basically kind of like, what is essential? Well, that depends on threat perception and how close you are to being how accurate your threat perception is, right? I mean, if Hitler really is a threat to France, the French should perceive that. And if the French have to be involved in a coalition, then they are essential, no? Then they're essential, right? The French have to be involved. They're going to be attacked. They have to do something. They're an essential component. They can't stick their head in the ground, right? And if Hitler's unappeasable, then they have to... So, I think I needed a chapter about what would be appropriate behavior given some threat or non-threat. So I ranked sort of, it's usually a rising power we're talking about. That's usually a balance, because we're talking about changes in the relative balance of power, changes in the relative capabilities. So,
where's the U.S.?
Where is the U.S.? Well, I'm just talking about, it's just an example of...
Britain.
Yeah, well, I know. I have this in my final chapter. I do. I understand your question.
Where's your book?
Our book is here. But I think you can look at a revisionist or a state as a threat by looking at two things. How risk accepted is it? What are its aims? What are the extent of its aims, right? And how willing is it to risk going to war to achieve those aims? I'm not saying this is obvious. That still begs the question, how do states know that and assess it? But I think there are differences between a risk-averse, limited-aims revisionist power and a risk-accepted, revolutionary state, right?
She noticed I put Stalin in the risk-averse. He was more of an opportunist. But anyway, you do have to, you know, there has to be a chapter about threats perception. I do. It's the second chapter in the book. And it's where I was talking about the cognitive things that I don't find the theories in cognitive psychology.
But if I get others to do my work, if I conclude that I should get others to do my work for me and not build my own arms, my non-balancing, my underbalancing, what am I doing?
If you don't build arms and you're essential, you're underbalancing. This is, by the way, I then had to come up with prudent policies. Now that you've recognized, you've categorized the threat, let's say, correctly, what should you do? And there are lots of things you can do, but I put that down. So, just so you can see it. Alright, I'll go to the next one. I'm not going to satisfy you, but I'll go to Alex and then Bridget and then...
I want to just follow up on a little bit and
ask a question I asked in Chicago. Okay. I'm ready for it.
I mean, you seem to be assuming that the leaders in states cannot rationally disagree about the nature of the threat.
No, I think they can.
But if they can't, but the whole rhetorical force of this argument is that underbalancing is irrational. We can look back in history and say, yes, it's irrational policy.
Right.
You can rationally disagree at the time, and because of our future uncertainty, which we have no way of knowing,
right?
Then sort of, what's really going on here, I guess? I mean, it seems like almost anachronistic. Go back in time and say you've got to underbalance. They didn't think they were underbalanced. They thought they had a rational assessment of the question.
I think they thought they were in most of these cases, believe it or not.
I mean, just one last thing. What if Rommel had not broken through the Mexican border against the French lines and you had a stalemate?
Wasn't Rommel?
Yeah, it was.
Well, Kadarian and Rommel. Right,
Kadarian, okay. Hadn't broken through and you got a stalemate like you had in 1940.
Right.
Then, French and British policy would not look so silly.
Right.
So a continued event like that would have changed our entire assessment today of their behavior prior.
But here, I think that you're arguing against the historians who, it's overwhelming in the literature that in the 1930s, appeasement was imprudent. I think there's so imprudent. There's so many books about...
Only if you understand that the way church works.
Right, but I think...
He guessed right,
and you're saying right. I've argued that I didn't think that anyone should say Chamberlain was naive because he perceived the same facts that Churchill did, and yet one of them had to be right. And at the time, I agree that it's only Hitler could have been a pan-German, or he could have been this crazy, you know, one person wanted to take over the whole world. And at the time, it was inconclusive. You know, at least by 36, it was inconclusive. I think by 37, 38, after the Anschluss, and then, well, certainly after 39, you have to say. But I still think a prudent policy would not have said, given uncertainty, well, he could be a pan-German. I'm saying I assume the worst. At least a prudent policy, you do a little more balancing than the British did. They didn't even have staff talks with the French, right? I mean, it was just, you know, appeasement isn't going to work unless you have an iron fist behind it, right? I mean, it wasn't prudent to do what the French and British did. Whether Hitler turned out to be what he did, I still think it wasn't prudent. But let me go to Don, and then I know.
My only response to that one is I can't believe anybody's naive enough to have stated what your straw man is.
But they are. They are.
But the question, I guess it's a little, it's somewhat similar to where the folks are going here. It strikes me that you have to live in one of two camps at some point, mm-hmm. or at least have a dual logic in mind. One of those is to say that what you are trying to categorize is, in fact, people's perceptions, understandings at the moment.
Right.
And therefore, your sources for that have to literally be not historians after the fact, but folks who were actually looking at it at that moment. Or you have to say, no, this is only going to work post facto in terms of our understandings. You've got to live with one of those, and you can't jump
out. I definitely live with the first one. And if you read the article of the book, you'll see in the cases, I make the case that a prudent person would have balanced. And
I mean, I understand that. I'm not taking cases where the house wasn't on fire or where it was really that ambiguous. I mean, Paraguay was arming for 25 years. Brazil should have been arming against Argentina, and Argentina should have been arming against Brazil, but they weren't. And they were neither one was arming against Paraguay. I mean, this guy, he created an armed camp. Like I said at one point, that no school, no road was built without a military purpose behind it. They were just obsessed with projecting military power and arming themselves and creating a garrison state. And I understand this question about ex ante post, you know, ex post. And I do understand. It's covered in the book, but I don't think it's that, you know.
As long as your word should have.
Yeah, I mean, if you just... I would be surprised if somebody reads the article of the book and says, you know... But maybe that says, you know, at the time, both... in the article, I say, it's a theory of mistakes. I am. I'm giving you a theory of mistakes. But there are mistakes only in a sense of... And this is very important. I don't think it came across in the talk. Is that there are mistakes only if you look at the geostrategic environment, the systemic environment, and not the domestic scene. If you look at, see, I don't agree with Walter's, states can do any fool thing they want. I mean, I agree with that, that his theory says the states can do any fool thing they want. But I don't think it's so foolish sometimes when you look at politicians operating in a domestic environment that will have all these hurdles, it may not be foolish if your idea is to stick around for the next election or the next whatever. So I think it's a theory of mistakes, but only from a purely structural view. Yeah. Well, Bridget, then Rick, then Paul.
Can you talk about the strategic interaction among states in balancing and how that played in? Because you've got all of the actors coming to the table, right?
Mm-hmm.
And oftentimes balancing involves cooperation. So why isn't it just a cooperation problem, a tragedy for the states that should be balancing, have the preferences to balance and end up not?
So this is the collective action problem. So I got some of this critique, a criticism. One reviewer said that, there's this notion that there's a big literature on collective action problems and alliances. I don't see it. I see mostly collective action problems and burden sharing within alliance. That's the Olson, Zeckhauser, you know, piece. But, yes, I think some balancing can be explained by purely collective action problems, I guess. You know, I'm willing to concede that, but I don't think that was the case with Britain and France in the interwar period. I've made that argument in my first book, because I don't think, in order to be a collective action problem, there has to be a free rider problem, right? And a free rider problem assumes that it's a public good or a collective good. But if Britain were balancing against France, Britain was secure against Germany, it doesn't mean that France was, and if France was secure, it doesn't mean Britain was, and I don't know, I agree, there are collective action problems. That's what you're saying, right? All right, I agree. There are structural reasons why you can get underbalancing. But I think domestic, I'm just focusing on domestic ones. I still think a theory of balance of power has to have a domestic component. It just has to have it. Rick?
Yeah, I'm wondering about the theoretical engine under these problems. I think, certainly, I agree with you that we need to look at perception of foreign policy. I think
you do?
You,
oh my God, what a convert. I
shared for quite a while by a lot of people. And some of the standard critique of that approach, though, has been that, you rest a lot of your work on perceived threat or perceived opportunity, and you go out and empirically discover what that is. In your case, you add social cohesion about all of that. And there's a lot of empirical work that works in that area. And then the theorist usually says, but so what? I mean, I want to know why some people see threat and others don't. In some ways, your independent variable is so close to your dependent variable that the theory is not all that exciting. Because what you've shown me is the people who don't see threat don't act, the people who do see threat do. And you've said the whole explanation is whether or not they see threat as sort of an empirical reality. And so now I'd like you to explain to me.
Okay.
And some people have. You know, like Errol Solingen has a theory that tries to connect people's location in the economy to their inclination to see threat and global environment. Your teacher, Jack Snyder, tried to build up a theory based on economic. I'm working on a theory of national identity as it generates perceived exponential. But you're not taking that next step.
Mm-hmm.
So for me, you know, your word you're looking for might be denial.
You know, that's good. That is good.
For instance,
right. Okay.
I still don't think.
Rick.
There's a huge psychology. I think there's a huge psychology of people who deny threats and deny injury or disease.
I guess what I'm looking, do you think you need a deeper explanation?
I think I mischaracterized the theory in the sense that there's only like 15 pages on threat perception from a cognitive perspective, and it doesn't show up in any of the cases. Like, I never rely on threat perception. Stalin would be a classic case of somebody who thought he was very secure and trusted Hitler for some reason. I don't know why. Against all the evidence, he just thought, Hitler's not coming to get me, and they're all saying he's coming to get me, he's coming to get me. Then, no, I trust Hitler. I don't know why he put all this trust in him. But that was the only case that I mentioned that it's clearly some pathological or cognitive problem why he doesn't perceive a threat. All the other cases are pure political risks, political costs at the domestic level. I'm not relying on threat perception. I'm not relying on, it's just simply, it's too costly to balance. I'm saying, like, if you look at the system, if you look at policymakers' decisions, looking at it from both a domestic and an international level, then you can understand when you factor the domestic costs of balancing why they don't do it. And maybe I didn't present it that way, but I'd say social cohesion was about that, the cost. And there are two components. Like, I read that thing about why you wouldn't balance. There are two things, willingness to balance and ability to balance. And the willingness is, they all have to do with the policy costs, like policies can fail or they can succeed, or the political costs and risks. And it's not about perception. In most cases, I think they did perceive a threat. You know? They did perceive a threat. But they didn't act prudently from a systemic view. But if you look at the domestic, they probably did.
Thank you, question. You're asking why there's no social cohesion. It's because the threat's not shared by all the people
right.
in the community. Why not?
Because they're multi-ethnic states. I talk about oversized states. There are oversized states that are where ethnic groups are subjugated or feel subjugated, and so they have no loyalty to state, which brings in a Trojan horse dilemma where they don't know if they arm these people whether they turn arms against the state or whether they'll fight the enemy. You know, so there are all kinds of reasons for social fragmentation and that complicate balancing. I'm saying the realist state is the unitary actor state. That, you know, is the state is unified. Like I say, when I write this final chapter, I'm going to write about fascist state. I was just reading about fascism recently, several books, and I noticed that the fascist state looks just like Mearsheimer's realist state. That, you know, it's unified, it has an ideology of aggression, and all these kinds of things, myths, and all these things that unify the country, and very much like Paraguay in the 19th century, or Germany, or Italy, or any of these states, or even Japan. I mean, they're totalitarian, they're not quite fascist. But I'm saying that's the realist state that will behave according to what realism expects, given certain changes in the external environment. But most states don't look like realist states. They don't look like fascist states. I mean, I guess this theory applies much more to democracies than others. And I mislead you if I say that it's all about threat perception. It's not about threat perception. So I say, still, even though you heard the talk, please read the article, at least. Because it's much better, I think. Paul, and then...
Just think about prudent strategies in response to potential threats. I wonder if there's something independent of perception or whatever, the objective threat that states are facing. And all of war is something like offense and defense theory, where you have military strategies, where you see this great threat, you see that Germany is actually a huge threat to everybody, but you have time to react. Once it attacks, because of your predominant use of military operations, how things are actually going to work, you don't realize that they're going to roll through and so forth. So it's something, I mean, it just strikes me there's so many different things in it.
But you could also use the United States. Like, let's not use Nazi Germany for everything. I mean, the United States today, right? Why is nobody balancing against us? They carp about it, they say we're so horrible. I mean, part of it's structural that they can't balance. But I find it hard to believe that 350 million Europeans can't build a force to, you know, they have as large a GMP as not larger. They have just as many people. They have, so, like, once again, like today, why aren't they balancing against the U.S.? Maybe, you know, domestic hurdles to balancing. They don't feel it necessary to do it because it's too costly to start building arms. I mean, couldn't that...
But the larger point
they're not
is
balancing.
That you have to consider the middle.
I define balance. He says, how do I know they're not balancing? I just want to answer it. Because the way I define balance, you've got to build military capabilities or form alliances. Military, it has to be some capability aggregation. It isn't this bull about soft balancing, like they're carping at us, or they don't like our policies, or opposing
policies. So if one of them is Europe underbalancing now against the United States?
Yes, that was my point. It's underbalancing.
Because the U.S. is a threat.
It's a threat in the sense that if they want any political, if they want political input commensurate with their potential capabilities, they need to build a military force. It's like they all say, we don't like what the U.S. is doing, but what can we do about it? Well, nothing, right? Really, right now.
Political fragmentation is one reason states don't balance. Maybe the first thing to do is to unify politically.
Yes.
And then you can actually build up. So they're balancing.
That's what I said in my chat, that there are two stages of balancing, that they're in a delegitimation phase, that nobody wanted this in the book. I think it goes in the book, but everyone who reviewed it, four people said no. But it was this idea that we're in a delegitimation phase, which is precisely that. We have to delegitimate U.S. power, unify various countries or in Europe, unify Europe, and then you have a plan of action so that now you can build up capabilities. And you see, the problem with the unipolar system is that balancing, which is always a conservative policy, is very revisionist in a unipolar system because you're actually overthrowing the system. Any other system, balancing would be to maintain the equilibrium. But here, you want to overthrow this current system. So you first have to delegitimate it and blah, blah, blah. So yeah, it is about politics. I just want you to know, this book and article is much more about politics than perception. It isn't, you know, I'm misleading. Daniel, did you?
Sure, yeah. That goes back to your first question. The only thing is that disagreements and division in the balancing and the receiving countries, what about the aggressor? You know, if the aggressor, or Paraguay, of course, Paraguay may be an example. But if you suspect that Hitler could go either way,
right.
You know, there is a moderate, like Iran right now, you have the mullahs and you have the liberals, and we don't want to press them too hard not to basically put the mullahs in power, right? So, non-balancing in this particular case, but it's rational.
Right. Yeah, that's a good point. That's a very good point. Somebody also, I've got to integrate this. This is like peeling the onion, you know, it just keeps layer after layer after layer. This is a good point. Your point is that, okay, I can fragment the aggressor by not balancing against, because balancing only united. Okay, that is a very good point. I've got to incorporate that. But there's another way, too. If you're a smart aggressor, you should pick off factions in the other state. You should, you know, a smart aggressor will, like, soften up the states by trying to fragment them, too, right? So I'm not disagreeing with you. I'm just saying it could work the other way, too. The aggressors should be able to fragment or try to fragment. And they do. We know they do, right? I mean, this is the whole case. The Soviet Union was trying to pit Europe against, you know, to break up the Atlantic Alliance by pitting Europe against the United States and blah, blah, blah. So, yes. Yeah, I agree with you. I have to look into that. Did you have a question?
No, go ahead.
That's the point that I want to ask. I mean, first point is in your schema where you say that what the state, revolutionary state, and what revolutionary state, and kind of, you know, these state do, and one of them is like preventive war. It is kind of, it is for me, that's supposed to be done by kind of limited in state with, I mean, with a,
I think that
one more argument here, the second is actually doing a preventive war, and here it has a very limited aim.
No, but. Right, but.
Let me see the second.
Yeah, but I think if you wanted to eliminate, you know, Germany, Nazi Germany in the 30s, the best way to do it was to attack them in 36.
Yeah, but that's the thing.
They had no forces in 36, really. I'm just using it as a prudent policy. I mean, it's Gilpin. It seems to me like it's one of two: aggressive bouncing through arms and all. If you can contain it, or you can, you know, wage a preventive war. I guess.
I think the preventive war is for you need to change the mission. I can't want to lose because when the mission is tough, the preventive war doesn't mean that you want to take over the other thing, but. You just want to make sure that they will not attack you in the end.
Well, you
could
have the preventive war
too.
You what? You could have the preventive war
on
the top right
cell
as well.
This is what
you criticize the British for not doing.
I guess you're right. I could put it over there. I don't know. Yeah, preventive war is always a neat option. Yeah, it's nothing to do about. That just wipes out the problem one way or the other. I agree with you. I could put that anywhere.
And my second problem is, it's like you are underestimating the agency of the state. I mean, the fact that even in democracies or even in some of the states, if you have a good leader, you can create a myth
That's why I say if you have a unitary actor state, the closer state is to a unitary actor, more likely it will balance, like Real said. The more fragmented it is, that's what I call cohesive state. I'm not saying it's a good state, but it's cohesive. Like, I don't have a theory. One of the reviewers said, but you can't explain, you know, Russia, Soviet Union in the interwar period. I go, but I need a theory of Stalin to do that, you know? Like, the idiosyncrasies of Stalin. I want a general theory. Anytime you have one leader rules a state, it's very hard to make a generalizable theory about it. All I'm saying is that I agree with you. A unitary state is more likely to have the capacity to act like realists say. I mean, you have to understand, the main thing I'm saying is simply that there are many domestic hurdles to balancing. That balancing is extremely difficult to do. History shows that. And there are reasons for that. It's costly. You don't gain anything by balancing. Aggression, on the other hand, when you succeed, you get profit and all these good things, spoils. But you don't get any spoils from balancing. You just get spoiled, in some sense.
Right? The good thing about having local speakers
is that they never go away. So I want to thank you. And you can all follow up with him today, tomorrow, next week. Thank you all.
Thanks, Greg. That was good. Thank you. Let's read the article. Yeah, yeah.
But my point is, I mean, when you ask me about what kind of state, I mean, to balance, I mean, you cannot really, I mean, you have to look at what kind of myths you are creating. I mean, the reason why the British didn't really balance against the Germans is because they already have the myth that it is not the fascists that's the problem, but it is the communists.
But why? Why did they have it? I agree. I have that there. But why did they agree with that? You know, and even if they do, that's still a problem, right? What I'm saying is that it isn't logical to just assume that, you know, that Germany is the number one threat. Some saw the Soviet Union as the number one threat, right? So you're just making my point that there can be a elite disagreement about what's the number one threat.
I have one point that I go ahead. Khrushchev's USSR, British USSR, Stalin's Russia.
Yeah. I just have the moral risk of, I think Stalin's
Russia. No. This is terminology. Oh. USSR, Russia, Stalin's Russia.
Yeah, it's just the way the historiography always says it. Stalin, Russia.
It always bugs me because they say.
Yeah.
You
know. Well, I can live with that.
It's more likely to be true to say Stalin's.
I like. All right. I like that kind of criticism. You should review my book.
I was just gonna ask you
because those are easy things to change.
That's why I wanted to know.
Yeah.
You noticed in the book and in the article you wrote in ISQ back in '93 that the British actually increased their defense spending starting in early '37 to by about 200%.
Let me read you the figures. What do I got? Okay. Britain. Between 1920 and 1938, British defense spending was consistently less than 5% of national income per annum, less than at any time before or since. And this is at a time when Britain's imperial commitments had almost reached a maximum historical extent.
Yeah,
From 20 to 38, that's the lowest national income per annum spent on military defense.
Yeah, but I mean, but you still, the point was that they had increased their spending on defense by 200. They had increased their defense budget by 200, by better than 200% starting in 37.
But it was such a low base that it's meaningless.
Yeah, but even so, I mean, even at 5% of GDP, Kennedy says at that point.
But it's the lowest. But I'm still pointing out it's the lowest in British history before our sense.
Okay.
So, and this is a time when their imperial commitments were their largest. So a lot of that's going to imperial commitment. So you just read the article, you'll see. I have to give this to Julie.
Back again,
I just think that, I mean, that's one of the reasons why he got elected.
I need to get a picture of you. Thank you. I wonder you're passing out.